Lunar Science. Welcome to Lunar Science, the series in which we discuss the scientific investigation of the Moon and its environment in the Artemis era. In Episode 7 of Lunar Science, we again consider the small unmanned missions to the Moon. The Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, or LRO, has been orbiting the Moon since 2009. Paul Hain of the University of Colorado realized that LRO has one shortcoming. It cannot see into the dark shadows of the polar craters. Now, LRO has no night vision. In July of 2020, he proposed a solution.
Okay, so this is a short presentation on the utility and science applications of thermal infrared imaging at the lunar surface for surface science. So the context for this is the Diviner radiometer instrument. So we've been flying Diviner on LRO in lunar orbit for upwards of a decade now. So we've learned a lot about the lunar surface thermal environments and the subsurface as well. This is at a scale that is resolvable from orbit of 250 meters per pixel by Diviner. So the question is, what's going on down on the surface at smaller scales? And we have some insights into this, both from Diviner and from modeling. So the first point is that the thermal gradients on the surface are extremely large, so hundreds of degrees per centimeter. And that's just due to the thermally insulating properties of the regolith. Surface roughness and therefore shadowing also increase at smaller scales, and that's important for creating these cold regions. We also know that the smallest cold trap is about a centimeter across, so we also have a modeling paper that's coming out soon that shows that that's about the scale of the smallest cold trap is about a centimeter, so that's a scale to keep in mind. Then also roughness, this is an important point that extends beyond thermal considerations and ice itself, but roughness contaminates both Diviner data and near-infrared spectra, which is important for detecting both H2O and OH on the surface. That 3-micron band gets contaminated by emission from this rough surface. So we designed the Lunar Compact Infrared Imaging System to get down on the surface and resolve some of these uncertainties on the small-scale temperature distribution on the surface, as well as the small-scale composition and mineralogy. So this instrument feature is based on the Cirrus CubeSat instrument, which is currently in Earth orbit. It's a radiometer featuring four different infrared bands from 7 to 14 microns. You can see the specific. The critical thing is that we can resolve down to scales smaller than a centimeter within a few meters of the lander, and then extending the field of view all the way out to the horizon. We also have a rotation stage that allows us to build up panoramic images from the landing site. So the science objectives flow down directly from some of the high priority science from both the SCEM report and the strategic knowledge gaps from HEO, what can be done from the surface with thermal infrared imaging related to volatiles, since that's the topic of discussion here. So looking into the future, of course, we can anticipate more of this kind of thermal infrared imaging. What could we do with thermal infrared imaging from the surface if also coupled to mobility? So an astronaut could carry a thermal infrared camera like L-Cirrus on the surface and rapidly identify hazards like rocks and loose soil Also assess the geology to make quick decisions about what to investigate in a limited amount of time during a traverse. And then importantly for this discussion, also identify cold traps. Imagine being able to just look out and see where the cold. So the point I want to make here is that before we can follow the water per the NASA directive, we need to find the cold. And the cold traps span a wide range of spatial scales, and so we really need to get down on the surface and use thermal infrared imaging to find them. Thank you.
And here's Paul Hayne again from the University of Colorado. He has proposed a different way to look into the shadowed areas. He wants a lunar flashlight.
I'm going to talk about the lunar flashlight mission. So this is a low-cost, high-risk, high-reward mission that was originally selected by the Advanced Exploration Systems Program within NASA's Human Exploration Directorate. So the objective of the mission is to identify water ice at the surfaces within permanently shadowed craters. So this is sort of preaching to the choir, but the thing I wanted to, where we sat down and talked about lunar volatiles for a couple of weeks and what measurements needed to be made to really advance the field. And this is back in 2014, but I think this stands up to now. And the upshot of it is that basically, even though the science and exploration communities want different things out of the measurements that we need are, for the most part, the same. Very few measurements that only the science community cares about, and likewise, few measurements that only the exploration community cares about. And so these measurements that Lunar Flashlight will make are important both for the science and for exploration and ISRU. The motivation for wanting to make yet more measurements is that our existing data sets are often confusing or even in conflict. And so this is just one example of a region in the moon's south polar region with three craters, Hayworth, Shoemaker, and Faustini, that show differing amounts of hydration or water in three different data sets. And you can argue that they're each probing different depths or different types of water, but the fact is, when you really dig into it, these don't really match up with our models or expectations. And so we need to address this problem. I think the main reason for this is mostly a signal-to-noise issue. And so we just need better and more measurements of, in this case, the water frost distribution that Lunar Flashlight will measure. So the Lunar Flashlight mission has a very short duration. Again, it's a very high risk, high reward kind of operation. So it's a 6U CubeSat that will be launched on the EM-1 launch of SLS. It's the first flight of SLS. So we use the measurement approach. And again, the objective is to detect water ice on the surface of the PSRs, lasers in four different bands to measure the differential reflectance at those different wavelengths. So it's a long period orbit, a near rectilinear halo orbit with a very long period that gives us about 10 science passes during the 2-month primary mission. So these will be direct measurements of surface water frost from a CubeSat at multiple locations within the PSRs.
A CubeSat is a small satellite based on multiples of a cubic decimeter. Pam Clark is the principal investigator for the Jet Propulsion Laboratory's Lunar Ice Cube mission.
Hi, yeah, I'd like to just give a quick update on what's going on with Lunar Ice Cube. You know, our motivation for making an instrument that required a cryo cooler, a very big challenge for a CubeSat, a 6U CubeSat, is that we wanted to cover the 3-micron band based on early results. And we also believe, based on other work done with M3 data, that we will potentially see water even at relatively low latitudes. So we are basically looking at water as a function of time of day. We have a repeat pattern that allows us to go back over the same swaths about once a lunar cycle, about once a month or so. Expect to see probably something like 10% of the lunar surface at two or more times a day. So our our operational strategy is we take data about every half second or so. We have overlapping 10-kilometer fields of view as we are close in altitude. We also have the option of either changing the field of view or keeping it, making it larger so that we increase our effective signal noise ratio as we go toward the pulse. We have a narrowly polar orbit. Lunar IceCube is the most operationally complex CubeSat to date. We provide measurements on water absorption features, including liquid water in various forms, ice and hydroxyl, as a function of time of day. We'll also cover regions that are known well on the moon, get a sense of what happens as a function of latitude, and different types of terrains on the moon. And are we doing what CubeSats are supposed to do, creating an innovative and tailored solution with a standard platform?
Sarah Noble is the lead lunar scientist at NASA's Planetary Science Division. In April of 2021, she gave an update of her agency's progress in lunar science.
I just wanted to start out by talking about, you know, just reflecting a little on like what a great time it is right now to be a lunar scientist. We have so much going on, right? From orbit, LRO, Themis, Artemis up there still doing their things, going strong. We have some CubeSats that are coming up. We've got these CLIPS missions twice a year. We've got Viper coming up, and we've got the ENCSA folks in the lab learning lessons from Apollo. So, you know, left and right, everywhere you look, it's raining moons, which is awesome. It's a great time to be a lunar scientist. A little bit on Viper. Viper is moving forward. It is difficult to build a mission in the middle of a pandemic that has been challenging. And on top of that, I feel like this poor team, right? They've had to deal with wildfires in California. They've had to deal with floods and power outages in Houston. Sometimes it feels like, you know, Mother Nature is conspiring specifically against Viper, but the team is moving forward. They're doing great. They passed their KDPC in February, which is great. It means that they have now been confirmed officially as a mission, and they're still on track. They're moving forward to get to the moon at the end of 2023. Simplex, like I said, we've got some small sats that we're working on. So LunaMap from the Simplex 1 ROSES call is planning to launch on Artemis 1, and they are just about ready to deliver, I think expected in June, so good progress on that team. Trailblazer is our Simplex 2 AO collection. They are also doing great. They also just recently passed their KDPC in November, and they're looking to get a ride share with IMAP. That's actually a heliophysics mission, so we like to partner with the other divisions every chance we get. Note that we actually just had selections for participating scientists for the Korean Pathfinder Lunar Orbiter mission. This is Korea's first deep space mission. They're looking to launch about just over a year. A little bit of update on ANCSA. ANCSA, our Apollo Next Generation Sample Analysis Program. This is a program looking at some specially curated Apollo samples, and in particular, some that have never been looked at before, including a double drive tube where the lower half of the drive tube actually was sealed on the lunar surface. It's one of our three remaining lunar samples that haven't yet been opened. We have now opened the top half of that drive tube, not the sealed half, but the upper half, which hadn't been opened. We opened it just before the pandemic hit. And so we had just started to get some samples out, the very earliest samples, and then they sort of got shuttered. But they have been able to get back into the lab late last year. They were able to get back in the lab and start processing again. And so now those samples have started to go out to the team, and they are working hard on them. There were special sessions at both AGU and LPSC with some of their first results, some really exciting stuff coming out in science and also in terms of lessons learned about how we curate things and whether, you know, the way we did it during Apollo is the right way or not. And so that's some good things too. And we are working on getting that lower core opened. It's a delicate thing. You can only do it once. And so we're being very sort of cautious and careful. We're working with ESA to develop a gas extraction tool so that we can pull those gases out that have been hopefully saved in there since they were on the moon. That tool should be delivered this summer, I think. And so I think we're looking for sort of late summer, early fall. So we'll see exactly on the timing of that, but we're getting close to being ready to do that. So that will be some excitement coming up.
The space industry is awash with acronyms. Now, you and I both know what Moonlight is, don't we? Well, Simon Del Agnello of the National Institute for Nuclear Physics in the Italian city of Frascati has made up an acronym that spells out Moonlight. Moon as in moon, L for laser, I for instrumentation, G for gravity and geophysics, H for high accuracy, and T for tests.
This is a talk about lunar laser ranging and laser light reflectors. So this introduction, the wide introduction given by Yus Lama was very useful to set the stage. I'm going to be talking about Moonlight, which is a next generation lunar laser light reflector for gravity and geophysics, and it's a point and actuator MPAC. So I'm giving this talk on behalf of a collaboration of people from INFN Italy, University of Maryland, Doug Curry, the Italian Space Agency, Space Geodesy Center, University of California, San Diego, Tom Murphy, and at the Center for Astrophysics, John Chandler, and two universities and NFN units in Italy, in Padua and Naples. So this is the national framework. Our core instrument, the next generation lunar laser light reflector, has been developed together with the University of Maryland by Doug Curry and our group in Italy, and near Rome in Frascati. We have proposed this instrument together to ESA and to NASA for lunar missions. We were selected both by ESA and NASA. So recently, in 2019, our Moonlight reflector, which is the same core payload that developed with University of Maryland, the pointing actuator, a dust cover actuator, has been selected after a lunar science request for information. We are now under contract. And we have a launch agreed between NASA and ESA. It will be Eclipse mission with participation by ESA under PRISM 1A. It will go to the Rainer Gamma crater at the end of 2023. Our science PI is Marco Muccino from INFN. Similarly, in the US, Darko presented the proposal. We are a co-PI group with him. He was selected in 2019 by NASA within the Lunar Science Instrument and Technology payloads. The launch is foreseen at the end of 2023. It's a NASA Eclipse mission. The mission is called Blue Ghost, and it will go to the Mare Crisium. So our mission, PRISM 1A Eclipse, so in jargon is CP11, will go to the Rainer Gamma crater. As everybody knows, it's a swirl. It is associated with the magnetic anomaly. Its coordinates are close to 59 degrees west, so it's pretty close to the lunar limb in that region, so it's very useful for lunar laser ranging measurements. So we are working in Italy with the Italian Space Agency. We have a joint lab completely dedicated to laser reflectors and laser ranging. We're also partnering with NASA Survey, which is managed centrally at NASA Ames in Silicon Valley. We have an affiliation partnership since 2014 and an association at space agency level since 2017. So in this picture, you see the kind of payloads and destinations on which we are working with a number of partners, ASI, ESA, NASA, Survey. We made reflectors, which are now on Mars with the recent Mars surface missions. We are working on Earth observation payloads. I will describe the main laser reflector for the moon in this talk. Large laser reflector arrays, which we are manufacturing now for Thales Alenia Space and Airbus for Galileo second generation, a model of the LAGOS spherical satellite, which is used for geodesy and to measure the lens steering effect. LARES 2 has been manufactured by us, INFN, and delivered to us at the end of 2020, and that will be launched by ESA in early 2021. So it's another experiment which is useful for test general relativity, in particular the lens steering effect. And then we are also making smaller macroreflectors for comet and asteroid missions, like the ESA HERA mission to the Didymos double asteroid. So quickly, why did we go from arrays to single reflectors? Basically, the laser return by single large reflectors is roughly comparable to the one of the Apollo arrays. This is because the laser return scales as the fourth diameter of the power. Initially, then, our reflectors will clean from dust. Therefore, we will not suffer from the factor of 10 reduction, which has been estimated by Tom Murphy et al. In the paper you see at the bottom. So we expect that in the beginning, for the first years, 5 to 10 years, the new reflectors will perform as well as the Apollo reflectors. If you have a single reflector instead of an array with a size of about 1 meter, like the Apollo reflectors, then you are unaffected by the broadening of the time broadening of the return pulse, laser pulse from the moon. And so with the sparse arrays of single large reflectors, you have basically, which is a wide pulse of 2 nanoseconds, it becomes much, much narrower, potentially very, very narrow, just limited by the width of your electronics and detector response. So the new reflectors developed by Maryland and INFN will give a range accuracy which will be below a millimeter for a single shot from an instrumental point of view. So talking only about the space segment. The scientific objectives we want to achieve. So Slava did a very comprehensive introduction, so I don't need to go into any detail of this, but just remind you some of the topics we want to work on. The equivalence principle, so it comes into flavors, so the weak and strong equivalence principle. We want certainly to contribute to the measurements of the possible time variations, violations of the fundamental constants like the Newtonian Big G. We want to test metric theories by measuring the post-Newtonian parameters and then study fundamental properties of the moon interior. So this is something we want to do with the Lunar Geophysical Network, which is a global effort started more than 15 years ago, now led by Clive Neal and Renee Weber. Recently, we published a paper, Haviland et al., which explains the how we chose the landing sites for this proposal. In the long term, ESA has a new lunar program, a vigorous lunar program, and it foresees a European large logistics lander, which will be able to deliver many hundreds of kilograms of payloads to the lunar surface. So that's a good prospect for the next 10 plus years. And then we performed in 2020 a Lunar Geophysical Network mission concept study funded by NASA. Lunar laser ranging is one of the core technologies, like for the Apollo reflectors. The final report, you find it at the red link. It describes the whole project and the opportunity of proposing this for the New Frontiers enhancement opportunity, which is about to be issued by NASA.
In October of 2021, Jason Mazilius was principal investigator for a suborbital test of an instrument he called Lunar Exocam. 2 months before, he gave this description of his experiment.
Of a poster entitled In-Situ Measurement of Lunar Dust Plume Migration. My name is Jason Mazilius. I'm the principal investigator. So Lunar Exocam is a payload that is being funded with a generous grant right now from the NASA Flight Opportunities Program. And it is a remotely deployable sensor and payload device. Basically, there's an ejection system, and then there is a camera and sensor module. And we're going to be flying that on a Masten Zodiac suborbital test vehicle in October. And we're going to launch two of these camera sensor payloads off the rocket. One will be from 25 meters, another from 15 meters. And each Lunar Exocam payload complement is there's going to be one 360 degree field of view HD camera, video camera at 30 frames per second. So it basically sees the entire spherical format. And there's going to be a particle sensor system with that. We're going to get to that in a bit. And the way it works, and the generally how this payload works, is as a lunar lander, or in this case our terrestrial Zodiac lander, is coming down for landing, camera basically is going to eject from the rocket while it's in descent, and it's going to land. We have now landed in the plume that's being cast out from all the regolith that's getting dispersed from the thrust of the engine during final descent here. And this is where it gets really helpful, because we're going to have particle sensors covering this whole system. And this is something that's never been measured before. There's never been any in situ, direct measurement of this plume migration on the lunar surface. So the camera design, it's a GoPro Max. It's a standard, it's a newer model that GoPro put out that basically, as I said, covers a full 360-degree spherical view. So every angle simultaneously. Because of that, the design of the payload itself can be very simple. There's no moving parts. It's just this basic wire cage, and it protects it no matter what angle it lands. We've tried to break this thing. It's surprisingly tough. We've dropped it from over 50 meters height. We've tested it. It's crossed 50 Gs, but we haven't managed to get it to break 100 G impact yet. And we're actually toughening it up even more before the flight test. So about the size of a basketball. And then the particle sensor system, constructed by Arizona State University, and like the camera, there's going to be these, it's going to be a full spherical field of view, if you will, of the sensor system. So no matter how this lands, these little piezoelectric sensors are going to be on all sides, and they're going to record, each of those is actually going to record into a separate data channel. So, and that's it. It is time to fly. So,
meanwhile, at NASA headquarters, Brad Bailey is the program scientist for CLPS, the Commercial Lunar Payload Services Program.
I'm really here to talk to you all about how we go about making landing site decisions. You know, this is just a quick reminder of what we are planning on doing with CLPS within the next 4 years. Between now and 2025, we have 10 landings on the lunar surface planned, and many of them are already on contract with our CLPS vendors. Of course, we're starting out with Intuitive Machines and Astrobotic in 2022, and then also in the machines with delivery of STMD's Prime 1 to the South Pole in 22. We're also delivering Viper and going to the South Pole with Volatiles Investigations and Mare Crisium with geophysics instruments in 23. We've got one delivery in 24, Reiner Gamma. Many of you probably saw Intuitive Machines was selected for that. And then we have a slew of things coming up in 25, including the PRISM 1B deliveries of FSS and Litmus to Schrodinger Base. And then we also are going to Gruithuisen and another South Pole delivery in 25. So, long story short, there's a wealth of opportunities coming up to get instruments down to the lunar surface. Now, that said, kind of a little bit of the history of how we got to where we are. We had the initial calls when we were first standing up the CLPS program for the NPLPs and LSIPPs. And those were largely schedule driven. We were largely soliciting for instruments that were fairly high TRL. They're flight spares or engineering units, et cetera, that were reasonably far along in development so that we could make sure that we had an appropriate manifest for those early deliveries. Now, that said, even though they were scheduled driven, they were also expecting high quality science from them. It's not just, we weren't just throwing any old thing on there. There's high heritage for all of these and reasons that there's high heritage for them. So we do expect high science, and we wanted to demonstrate that good science could be done from the CLPS platform. Now, we wanted to evolve that philosophy into a little bit more science question-driven investigations, and that's where PRISM comes in, where we're really focused on a specific question that can be answered with a suite of instruments, and then we go from there. And then as we continue to evolve the program, we'll get increased capabilities from the vendors that come at a cost. But those increased capabilities will continue to afford us evolved and enhanced investigations from the lunar surface. And so as we're moving forward, we'll be integrating in those increased capabilities into that science strategy. Then there are budget considerations, vendor capabilities, there are agency priorities, we have international contributions, and then timelines and schedules that are all factors. First and foremost, of course, is science. Why are we doing this if it's not for science? And so really, science is the primary driver for what CLPS deliveries are doing. It's also important to remember that it's not just geological sciences that we're representing here. All science is fair game. So heliophysics, astrophysics, biological and physical sciences and earth sciences are all represented in addition to planetary. We are committed overall to doing 2 deliveries per year. Each vendor has their own philosophy on how they're investing money in order to develop these new capabilities. They're trying to read the tea leaves and understand, you know, what NASA wants, and then they're going to make investments into providing that new technology for us. So having this roadmap and strategy in place ultimately helps those vendors with those strategic investments overall. At some point in the future, we're going to be asking for survive and operating throughout the lunar night capabilities, mobility, which you've seen in the PRISM 2 selection or announcement and solicitations on the street right now, EMI cleanliness for super sensitive measurements, operation in PSRs and cold regions. Definitely something we're really interested in and wondering if we can put the ingenuity and innovation of the commercial sector to use and figure out ways of doing that. And then, of course, sample return. Really would like to see whether the CLPS vendors are capable of bringing samples back for us. But again, these are all unknown costs per capability, and that does affect our long-term budgeting and planning. We can go forward with RFIs and try and figure out how much that's going to cost, but ultimately we won't know what that looks like until we actually ask for it and get bids in from the vendors to figure out how much each one of these costs. And so again, that makes it difficult for us to budget and understand how each of these are going to play out in the long run.